We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
I want us to look at this paragraph, verses 13 to 16. And I prepared this sermon a couple of months ago. And when I did prepare it, I started the week with joy and gladness in my heart that I was going to come to one of the easy week's work. You've had those weeks sometimes, haven't you? You go on Monday morning, and as you go into the office, as you pick up, you think, hey, I've only got to do these three things this week, and they're all a snack, and this is going to be a good week. And then as the day wore on, the task gets more and more difficult, and until the end, everything goes wrong, the wheel falls off, and you can't get anything done. I started this week's preparation thinking it was going to be a breeze. You look at salt, you look at light, there is a standard sermon that every preacher preaches on it. You've got it written before you've even read the passage. I mean, I didn't even have to read the passage, let alone translate it from the Greek or anything like that. I just saw, chapter 5, verses 13 to 16, I know my 3 points already. I've got this already. Well, all I've got to do is find a poem and a song to sing to them. You start off with the metaphors, salt and light. You say, what is salt about? Well, salt is about taste. Salt is about preservative. And so we use salt in the ancient world to preserve things. Not so ancient, depends how old you are as to whether you think it's ancient. And so that's what Jesus was meaning, that they are the salt of society. They are the thing that give it flavour. They are the thing that preserves it from corruption and rotting and putrefaction. And then secondly, they're light. Light is illumination. Light is knowledge. And so they are the ones who are to illuminate the community, the world, with the knowledge of the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. And so we can apply Jesus' teaching fairly easily to the disciples, to Christians, who are both salt and light at the same time, preserving and illuminating society and the world. Preserving through social action and activity, illuminating through evangelism. And so we have the wonderful balance. It's not either or, it's both and. We are people to be involved in social action, preserving our society through political structures, through governmental structures, through the good works that we do. And we are to be evangelistically minded people who will preach the gospel and illuminate the world with the message of the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, in order to kind of make a decent sermon out of it, I needed to just check out some of the background and give you some flavour and colour to illustrations to make the point. And so I just looked up a couple of things about salt and light, and I read this article which said that salt was not so much for preservation as for purification. And I thought, well, now, that doesn't quite fit with the sermon, but I won't worry too much because after all. And then it also said, and the earth is not the earth. In verse 13, it's the land. The word land can mean earth, can mean land, can mean soil in English and in Greek. Same thing. When I talk about the land, I can talk about the land as opposed to the seas, the whole land, so the earth, or I can use the word land to mean the kind of soil, the stuff that land is made of, or I can use the word land to mean the promised land, the land of Australia, or the promised land of Israel. And so this article would say two things are being told here. The disciples are to be the salt of the land, that is the purifying of Israel, and the light to the world, that is evangelizing to the ends, to the Gentiles, to the nations. Well, that doesn't just destroy my sermon totally, does it? We've still got social action and gospel taking place at the same time, but it starts to rattle it a little. So then I think, well, what is the background? What is salt used for in the ancient world? And so I started looking up some dictionaries on what the Old Testament, well, not the Old Testament, but the world saw salt as. Was it purification? Was it preservation? When I looked it up, I found that there are about a dozen different usages of salt in the ancient world. It was used for taste, it was used for preservative, but it was also used medicinally. It was also used for taxation. You paid tax in salt in some societies. It was used for rubbing into newborn babies in some societies to drive away evil spirits, in others as a cleansing of the afterbirth. It was used for judgment and destruction, and therefore was used when you cursed people. It was used in cattle feed. It was used as a fertiliser. It was used as a sign of friendship and loyalty. To eat salt with somebody was to be a long-term friend with them. It was used in all the sacrifices, and they even made covenants of salt. Now, that didn't help me all that much. You see, now my sermon is falling apart. Now I've got too much information, and information I don't want that I can't actually fit in. What did Jesus mean when he talked about the salt? The same kinds of problems, not as big, with light. What is the real option? So I thought, well, I can cull down the list if I just look at how the Old Testament uses salt. So there may be some usages of salt that are outside the Bible, but if I got the Old Testament background, then that would at least limit you down to the ones that Jesus would have been thinking of. So I looked them up. I got a printout on the word salt in the whole Bible and read through each of the references to salt, and I read some Old Testament dictionaries on salt, and all 12 were there in the Old Testament. So that didn't actually reduce the list at all. It just meant that any one of them could be seen by Jesus. That is, for example, in Judges chapter 9, when Abimelech destroys Shechem, he pours salt on the ground. Now, it's hard to know whether he put so much salt on the ground that he stopped anything growing, or whether he just did it symbolically by shaking some salt on the ground. But the way of judging and cursing Shechem was to salt the land. Or in Ezekiel chapter 16, we read of salting a baby. And there are other ones as well. Elisha comes across a well that has been poisoned, and he puts salt in the water and it becomes pure. That one's a little strange, to say nothing of Lot's wife, who turns around and watches Sodom and Gomorrah and turns to a pillar of salt. Now, what is it that Jesus is alluding to if he's alluding to the Old Testament when he says, "You are the salt of the earth"? Or even if he's not alluding to anything, what was the kind of thing he would be thinking of when he talked about salt and you being the salt of the earth? This didn't really help me to go back into the Old Testament any more than it did to go into the ancient world. The covenant of salt was a permanent friendship of loyalty, which is in the Old Testament. But all the sacrifices were salted, not for preservative purposes. The very essence of sacrifices is you're not preserving them. Flavour, possibly, but nowhere does it actually explain why they're salted. It just says, put salt in. So I thought, all right, well, if you can't find the answer from the ancient world, you can't find the answer from the Old Testament, what about the New Testament? What about Jesus? Where does Jesus use the word salt? And what does he mean by salt elsewhere? Well, the closest and best example is Luke chapter 14, if you'll come with me there, Luke chapter 14. He's calling upon his disciples to be wholeheartedly committed to him. If anyone would hate his mother, brother, father, unless you're willing to hate your family and your own soul, you can't be my disciples. Sit down, count the cost, he goes on. And he continues in verse 33, 14 verse 33. In the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is fit neither for the soil nor for the manure pile. It is thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Well, that's very similar. The context quite different, but similar. The idea of what do you do with salt that's lost its saltiness? And the answer is there. It is fit neither for the soil nor for the manure pile, but to be thrown out. Now, the word soil there is again the same idea of the word land. But here the translation is right, taking the soil element, because it's linked in here with the manure. In what sense is salt that has lost its saltiness no longer any good for manure. I mean, why would you keep a manure pile? It's not a garbage pile, it's a fertilising pile. And that is why it's no good for the soil. How will salt ever be good for soil but as a fertiliser? And so when Jesus is talking of the soil in Luke 14, he is thinking of soil in terms of being a fertiliser. Now, this is making progress. We're getting somewhere now. We've seen that there's many more options available than just taste and preservative. And here is an option that is specifically in the mind of Jesus in Luke 14. But was it in the mind of Jesus in Matthew 5? And how could I know it was in his mind in Matthew 5? When he says to them, "You are the salt of the land, or the salt of the earth, or the salt of the soil," was he talking about them, "You are the ones who are going to increase the yield and produce manyfold"? Is that the image that he has in mind? And if so, how could I know? I know it's an image he could possibly have in his mind because of Luke 14, but how could I know whether he has it in mind here in Matthew 5? And I take it that I can't know. Not unless he says so. You can't know what's in the mind of the author other than what the author says. He might have had any one of these references in his mind, but if he doesn't make it explicit, I shouldn't assume that it's there. I mean, the most likely, because of a biblical background, is fertilizer. But you don't determine it by biblical background, you determine it by what is actually stated, what is explicit. That is, digging around in history and digging around in the Bible does not give you any certainty about how to read, interpret, understand the Bible, about what Jesus was thinking, what Jesus meant. We're left just with uncertainty at this point. Now, for some people that's very frustrating, but I want to suggest to you that that uncertainty is very valuable, and not to jump in too quickly. Because there are any number of books, commentaries and the like these days that are being published and promoted which seek to give authoritative interpretation on what Jesus meant or Paul meant or John meant from the background of historical studies. But in fact, you never know anything more from historical studies than what you've got there in the text in front of you. It's an illusion, this background historical studies stuff. Because what has it done for us here? It helps us challenge assumptions. It helps us open up possibilities. It helps us disprove some theories. But it will not explain the meaning of the text itself. The thing that explains the meaning of the text is the text. That's where you've got to find the meaning. And that's very important to remember, friends, otherwise you'll wind up in the hands of experts. And that's a dreadful place to be. You'll have the Bible taken away from you, because unless you've got a PhD in archaeology, unless you've got a PhD in ancient history, unless you can, then you can't possibly know what the thing means. But there's nothing out there which will help you understand what the sense means other than what is there right in front of you. Can we know? Well, yes, I think we can know much more than we assumed. The uncertainty is valuable because it opens up our minds to possibilities and forces us to go back to Jesus' words and to actually ask what he did mean. For I don't find the meaning in the background, I find it in the foreground. We can spend so much time looking at the background that we've missed the point of the foreground. In fact, the key to interpreting the Bible is to read it. I know it's a strange activity, reading, It was common in primary and infant school when I was in those periods of education. We were taught to do it. And I've never really seen much reason to go beyond that. Reading is the essence of dealing with the Bible. Because it is God's word, reading it obediently is the essence of it. But we can get so sophisticated in our interpretative devices that we actually miss what's right there in front of us. So let's look again. Matthew 5, verse 13. You're the salt of the earth. If the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. Well, now if I'm going to read this, I must read it in its context. Well, what's the context? Well, you say, well, everything you've said so far is the context, the ancient world, Jesus' mindset, the Old Testament. But what's the foreground context? Well, this is part of what we call the Sermon on the Mount, and the Sermon on the Mount is part of what we call Matthew's Gospel. And Jesus has started his ministry back in chapter 4, verse 12, when John the Baptist was put in prison, and Jesus went up into Galilee and started to preach the kingdom of heaven. He went, we're told, up into Galilee in order to fulfil, chapter 4, verse 14, to fulfil what the prophet Isaiah said, that the new age is going to dawn out of Galilee. It's a strange place for it to dawn because Galilee was, from a Jewish point of view, the place of darkness. For when the northern Assyrians and the Babylonians came down south into Palestine to conquer, it was the northern parts that were conquered first. They were the places that came under judgment most frequently, most heavily. And so Galilee up north, that's the kind of place which God has seen fit to judge and condemn. But out of Galilee, not out of Jerusalem, the capital, out of Galilee is going to come the light of the great light has come. And as Jesus is preaching, the kingdom of heaven is near. And so he gathers around him Galilean fishermen. He calls four of them to be his disciples in order to fish for men for him. And then he goes throughout Galilee, chapter 4, verse 23, preaching and teaching and doing wonderful miracles so that huge crowds gather around him. And when the crowds from all over Palestine come up to Galilee, you know, it's like Mount Isa being the centre of the universe and everybody from over Australia going up to see the light of the new day coming from Mount Isa. I mean, it's out of the way, but it's worse than that. It's the place of God's condemnation and judgment. But they've done it. They've come from all over. Galilee, Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, the regions across Jordan, Syria, all over Palestine have now come up to this man. When Jesus sees the crowd, chapter 5, verse 1, goes up on the mountainside, his disciples come to him, they're the fishermen who are going to fish for men, and he starts to teach them. There's the context. The foreground context that we have. And Jesus teaching the fishermen how to fish for men starts off by setting out the values of the kingdom and teaches them the characteristic blessings of God. See, the new age is coming. The dawn of the new era is about to arrive. And this is what life is going to be like. Blessed are those who are poor in spirit, who mourn, who are meek, who hunger and thirst for righteousness, because with the coming of the new age, you're going to get the blessings of the new age. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, you're going to get righteousness. You'll be filled at last with righteousness. Those who are pure in heart, you're going to get your heart's desire. You're going to see God. The promises now are to be fulfilled with the coming of the new age. But strangely, verse 10, the last of these blessings is that people will be persecuted for righteousness' sake. But they too are blessed, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. But that blessing, the last of them, is then spelt out in verses 11 and 12, getting much closer to our context now here, aren't we? He spells it out, and he spells it out in terms of them. Previously it's blessed are those, blessed are those, blessed are those, but now it's blessed are you, you fishermen, you who have left everything following me in order to catch men for the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men hate you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad. Why? Your reward in heaven's great and you're in the best of company, the prophets of old. That's what they did to them. They hated them, they'll hate you. For you are the salt of the earth. It's still in the second person. We haven't gone back to them, they. We're still you disciples, you fishermen, you who are about to be persecuted for my sake, you who are about to be persecuted for righteousness' sake, you who are like the prophets of old, standing against the people of Israel in their sinfulness, you who are blessed like this, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. As I got older and my eyes have got weaker, the pitch at the Sydney Cricket Ground seems to be further and further away, and I find it harder and harder to be able to see the strokes being played. And so now I've got to pay much more attention not only to the backswing and the foot action, but I've actually got to watch the follow through very carefully if I'm going to ever pick up where the ball's got, especially that silly white ball in the late part of the year innings when it's turned grey and dirty grey. Very hard to see it, and I've got to keep watching the follow through, because the follow through indicates the direction as much as anything else. In the old days, I used to be able to just look at the face of the bat and I knew where the ball went. No, I used to be able to watch the ball. I used to be able to see the ball. In fact, I used to play with a ball. I'm not sure what they're doing anymore. Now it's about the third or fourth replay on the television monitor before I can actually see anything that's out there. Now, if you're going to understand what's here, you've got to watch the follow through as well. Okay, here is the context. Jesus preaching the kingdom, bringing the new age, collecting the disciples, teaching them the values of the disciples, teaching how those values are going to impinge upon them, how they're going to be persecuted, how they're going to be like prophets. He then gives the salt and light image. Now where does he go from there? Verses 17. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. I tell you the truth, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Anyone who breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven, for I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. So he's going to go on to talk about law-keeping and prophecy-keeping. He's going to talk about the fact that he is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. See, these people, the disciples, they're going to be like the prophets of old, persecuted like the prophets of old, and Jesus has come to fulfill the prophets of old. He's come to fulfill the law. You're not because of Jesus to do away with the prophets and the law. Because of Jesus, you are to fulfill and accomplish the prophets and the law. Indeed, what the Pharisees of today, of Jesus' day, what the Pharisees and the teachers of the law of Jesus' day know about law-keeping is so little that they're not even in the kingdom of heaven. The kind of law-keeping that Jesus is going to teach us about is the kind of law-keeping that is radically, dramatically different from his contemporaries. Indeed, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you won't even be in the kingdom of heaven I'm talking about. So that's where the shot's going to. Now let's get back to where the ball hits the bat. Verses 13 to 16 tonight, and see what it is that it's about. Having gotten the context root. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? That is, when salt has lost its saltiness, it's useless. Verse 14, you are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden, neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. A light under a bowl is useless. What's the point of lighting up a light and then hiding it? That is, the metaphors are actually not about salt and light. They're about what you do with salt and light. It's about what salt and light themselves do. It's not about the substance, it's about the usage. Salt and light, to be of any use, must be distinctive, must be different, must be observably distinctive and different. Salt must be salty. Must have that characteristic distinctiveness. It ever loses its saltiness, useless. Throw it away. Now, I've got to have a little diversion here for a minute, because there's a group of people sitting in this room who have got a major intellectual problem, and they're not going to listen to any other part of the sermon until I deal with this major intellectual problem. There's another vast majority of us who don't have a problem at all, but now that I'd say in a minute or two answering those who do have a problem, you're going to have a problem. So if the majority would like to have a little sleep for a while, I'll explain to the minority who are worried about it how come salt can lose its saltiness, because those who know anything of chemistry know that salt can't lose its saltiness, and so therefore they're not listening to anything that's happening because they're just doing all their chemical calculations again and saying Jesus didn't understand first year chemistry. Salt, of course, can't lose its saltiness, but that's not what Jesus is talking about. The salt in Palestine were basically dug up from the salt pans around the Dead Sea. The salt pans around the Dead Sea were very heavily mixed with gypsum, which was much the same colour and characteristic and appearance to it. And after usage for a while, the salt would be leached out and the gypsum would be left, and so you would have the white salty substance, which was just gypsum and therefore would not be salty anymore and would be useless. I told you it was not worth knowing. I told you I've wasted your time. I've told you, but come back and join me again on what the Bible is on about and stop asking such stupid questions. Not only is it salt, but it's light, but notice how the thing shifts. It's not just you are the light of the world, the light mustn't be placed under a bushel, the light under a bushel is useless, it's no use for anything, you may as well smash it and put it out completely. He also changes it. You are light of the world, a city on a hill cannot be hidden. That is, it's not just two metaphors that we have here, it's kind of two and a half metaphors. For a city on a hill is like a light being put on the top of a lampstand. Both of them have the same characteristic. You can't hide them. It's pointless to hide them. The very building of them up there on the hill, the placing on the lampstand, was so as to fill the whole house with light. And so again, it's not light itself that he's interested in, it's what light does to its surrounding environment, of which it only does it when it is fundamentally different, distinctive, observably so. The city cannot be hidden. The light on the stand lightens up the whole house. Now it's these twin elements of salt and light, or the city on the hill, which Jesus uses to preach his conclusion, which is really verse 16. And verse 16 is one of the most important verses, but we skip over verse 16 because we're so locked into verses 13 to 15 about salt and light. Let your light shine. Let your light shine before men in such fashion, in such way, that they can see the difference. And what difference is he talking about? That they can see your good works. But let it shine not like their good works. Let it shine on your good works in such a fashion that God the Father will be praised for them. See, people do good works in order that others may see them. There may be other reasons people do good works, but one of the reasons, which Jesus attacks in chapter 6 at some detail, verses 1 to 18, is that people do good works in order to be seen by others. And why do they want to be seen by others? So that they may be praised by others. The Wales rescue helicopter. If the Bank of Wales, New South Wales, or whatever it's now called, if they actually were concerned about helping people, they would just say the rescue helicopter. But they're not really just concerned about helping people, they're concerned about being seen to be helping people. And so by calling it the Wales rescue copter, and it's a good one, it can get onto the ABC where there's no advertising at 7 o'clock when there's a peak viewing audience every night of the week, because there's a rescue every night of the week, isn't there? And every time there's a rescue, there's the Wales rescue helicopter. And so the bank gets free publicity and people get rescued. Now, please don't get me wrong, I'm quite happy, especially when it comes to rescue time, to be rescued by the Wales, by the state, by the colonial, by the AMP. I don't care who rescues me, I'm just happy to be rescued. And if that gives free publicity to them, well, bully for them. But you'll notice the character of it. They do good in order to be seen, so that people will think well of them, so that people will praise them. For that's what happens when you do good deeds. But Jesus is saying, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Not praise you, but praise your Father in heaven. That's the character of it, isn't it? It's very different. Something unusual here, you should ponder it. That is, I can run around the streets in Kensington and help people with tarpaulins and tie ropes up. I can help them move furniture. I can help them clean up their houses. I can take them meals. I can do all kinds of things. And at the end of the day, people will say, that Philip Jensen is a lovely fella. He really is kind. He really is generous. He's a nice man. They will say all kinds of nice things in praise of me. I haven't yet praised my Father in heaven. So it's not just doing those kinds of good deeds, is it? Neither for the reason of getting praise, nor the kinds of deeds that will bring me praise. It's talking about the kinds of good deeds that will lead people to say, truly, that is God's man. God has his finger on him. He is a changed person. He is like God, the way he lives. Isn't God fantastic, what he has done to her, or done in him, or done with them, that they may so live that God the Father will be praised for you? Now, I think that's more than putting up a tarpaulin, very valuable as that is. I want to thank those people who helped finally put some sandbags on mine this evening. Very valuable, I'm all for it. But it's more than just doing the good deed here or there, isn't it? It's the kinds of good deeds that reflect well upon God and his work within us. They may not say it till the last day. For some people are too blind to God to recognise God when they see him in the hands and lives of people around about him. And on the last day, all kinds of people will say, we were wrong, they were right, they are God's people, I see it now. But it's not even just saying on the last day, it is that people will see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. That there is a character of life that Jesus has in mind for his disciples that far surpasses the righteousness of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. In fact, if your righteousness of life isn't a quantum leap ahead of theirs, you're not even in the kingdom of heaven. That is what he's going to go on and speak about. In other words, you don't need to know what salt is. You don't need to know what light is. You don't need to see it as the metaphor. The important thing, the important characteristic of the salt and the light has got nothing to do with whether it is fertilizer or something that destroys fertility in the land. It's that it is distinctive, observably, unmistakably distinctive. That is what you must be like. In this world, we are to stand out like beacons of light in the darkness. Such a way is that beaconing of light, is that our righteousness, our good deeds, will be like the Father in heaven. I saw a sad letter in the newspaper, written by a young woman, I don't know her from Barasov at all, Kate Waters from Concord West. No indication she's a Christian or anything, but she is young, judging by what she herself says. It is a sad letter in the Herald. It's called A Word to the Wise. Education is not, emphasised, education is not the key to drug prevention. As a young person, I find it extremely insulting that politicians believe that the reason we may lead unsafe lifestyles that consists of drugs and unsafe sex is because that we don't know any better or do not have access to effective education. Do they really believe those teenagers living in the streets addicted to heroin do not know what they are doing to their bodies? The question is not whether they have been educated. The question is whether they even care what they're doing to their bodies. Pouring money into programs that tell these kids that drugs are harmful and potentially fatal is both futile and ineffective. These kids already believe that they have no future. To effectively prevent so many young people turning to drugs, we need to look beyond the drugs themselves and beyond the law and its penalties. We need to look far deeper and see why these kids turn to drugs in the first place and to deal with the multitude of issues that lead them to believe that their future is not worth fighting for. It is sad, isn't it? Have people, sadder still because it is young people who have already decided that they have no future, who have already decided that there is nothing in life worth fighting for. But yet, our society teaches that there's nothing in life worth fighting for, really. We are discouraged for dying for any cause, and keep forgetting that if you are not willing to die for something, then you've got nothing to live for. Only those who've got something that's worth dying for have got something worth living for. If you live for yourself, you've got nothing to die for. You must keep living. If you live for yourself, futility will soon set in. What do we live for? What are we willing to risk our life for? What is it that would say, if we did not have that, I'd rather die? Jesus is talking about a life worth living. But a life worth living in this fallen and sinful world is a life that will be out of step with the people around about you. A life that will contest and condemn, challenge and confront everything in our society. A life that will lead you to stand out as distinctive and as different, and therefore lead you into unpopularity and even hatred. It'll be a life of light in the darkness. If you're not willing to be different to this world, if you're only going to be part of this world, then you can have no part in the kingdom of heaven. To be in the kingdom of heaven means that you must be fundamentally different, observably different, astringently different, offensively different. Not that you're offensive in behaviour and personality or manners, but offensively different in the very values of life that you have, the virtues that you pursue, the choices that you make, of career, of marriage, of housing, of home, of holidays, of eating, of whatever it may be, but it will be observably, unmistakably distinctive. It will be a praiseworthy life, but the praise will go to God the Father, because it will seem that you are one of his people. Praiseworthy not because of your achievements, but praiseworthy because of his achievement in you, his transforming quality in you. It will be a life of the Father. People do grow up to be like their parents, don't they? Those of us who are parents, it's horrible, really, when you see your children doing the same things that you do, especially the things that you don't want to do and you wish they didn't see you do because they do it. But it's manner, it's speech, it's character, it's turn of phrase, it's quirky little habits. People are like their father. People are to see the disciples and say, that is what God is like. Because whatever they know of God, they will see in the disciples. And it won't be something natural to the disciples. It'll be something decidedly unnatural that will lead them to say, God is truly great. Look what he has done to her. Look how he's changed him. And so it'll be a life of your Father in heaven. It'll be a life of poverty in spirit and mourning and meekness and hungering and thirsting after righteousness and being merciful and being pure in heart and being peacemakers. But it will be a life of persecution. Now the details of this we're going to spell out in the coming weeks, because that's where the sermon goes on. How are we different? In what ways are we different? What is the character of your law keeping that puts you quite apart from the Pharisees and the tax collectors? Sorry, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. In what way? Does this mean Christians wear a different kind of clothing or a different kind of hairstyle or live in different kinds of houses or drive different kinds of cars or listen to different kinds of CDs? What is it about us that is going to be so different, so distinctive? But before I just offer the opportunity for any questions or comments you want to be making, I want to conclude with a quote from a very old Christian. Well, he's not old, he died at 60. But he died a long time ago. A man called John Chrysostom. He died in 407. He was born in 347. Born in Antioch in Syria, and he was raised by a widowed Christian mother. He became an ascetic monk and then became the Patriarch of Constantinople, the kind of Archbishop of Constantinople in 398. Chrysostom was a great preacher. He was a Bible commentator, but in his preaching he challenged the corruption of the city of Constantinople. And because he challenged the corruption of that city, he was fiercely opposed by the powerful interests in that city, made powerful enemies, especially the emperor's wife. Ultimately, Chrysostom was deposed from his office and then exiled from the empire, where he was ordered to march effectively out of the empire, out into the wilds, where he died from exposure and exhaustion. But Chrysostom, when he was commentating on Matthew chapter 5, verse 13 to 16, said, and remember, baths mean swimming pools. When our neighbours see us building ourselves fine houses and laying out gardens and baths and buying fields, they are not willing to believe that we are preparing for another residence away from the city. Do you not hear Christ say that he has left us to be salt and lights in the world, in order that we may both brace up those who are melting in luxury and enlighten those who are darkened by the care of wealth? Is there anything about your life and your lifestyle that is different to the community around about you, such that people could see it and say, they're Christians? They wouldn't see it and say, oh, they're nice people. And they could say that of anyone. They'd actually say the kind of life they live, the way they do what they do, the good deeds that they do, that's the activity of Christian people. That will see your lifestyle so dramatically, radically different. For the problem for Christians is as old as St. Chrysostom. Their lives can be indistinguishable from the non-Christian community. If our life is indistinguishable from the non-Christian community, there's no way we'll fish anybody into the kingdom of heaven. Indeed, you've got to start wondering whether you're in the heaven yourself. Do you want to ask questions or make comments about what I may say? Or the passage in front of us?
You said that the good deeds we used to do were not the sort of good deeds like putting cup holders on people's houses. What kind of good deeds, sort of, in what way was that not the right sort of good deed? And what would be a good deed that does bring praise to our Father?
I said that I didn't think the good deeds that was being spoken of here was putting tarpaulins on people's houses. What's wrong with that good deed? What good deeds should be that would be the right ones that will bring praise to the Father? It is a good deed to put tarpaulins on people's houses when they need them. Not particularly good to be doing it at other times, it's kind of psychiatric. But it's a good thing to be doing. And it may well be a good thing that comes out of your Christian heart to do it. But that in and of itself will not point people to the Father in heaven. That's what I'm trying to say. But there are all kinds of, when we read it we say, oh, well, okay, so I do these good deeds. I help like Red Cross, I help with the, you know, this, I do this, I do. They're all good things. Please don't get me wrong. I don't want to stop you doing those at all. In fact, I want to encourage you to do more of them. But there's something more that Jesus is speaking about here, because what those kinds of good deeds do is produce praise for you. Whereas we've got to actually see praise to the Father out of the good deeds that are happening. Now, what kind of good deeds are those? Keep coming for the next exciting episode. Well done, well done. In 1 Corinthians chapters 8, 9, 10, that'll do, that's a good enough place. Paul is emphasising the need to be like people in order to reach people with the gospel. And so he says, I become like the Greeks to reach the Greeks, and for those outside the law to reach those outside the law, under the law for those who are under the law. In other words, in that part of the New Testament, we seem to have emphasised the need to become like the people. Whereas in the Sermon on the Mount, the emphasis is all on being different to the people. It's very important, therefore, that we clarify at what points we are to be like and at what points we are to be different. In general, Christians are like their non-Christian friends in the areas in which they should be different, and are different to their non-Christian friends in the areas they should be the same. Which is why we're not very good at reaching them with the gospel. We're not good with reaching them with the gospel, because in any kind of commonality where we could build bridges and talk to them, we're radically and dramatically different. And then, when we actually want to get into a relationship and can say something, we've got nothing to say because we're exactly the same as them. What we've got to be is different in the areas of the kingdom of heaven and the same in areas of unimportance. Now, 1 Corinthians 8, 9, 10 would show me the areas of unimportance. Matthew 5, 6, 7 is going to show me the areas of real importance where we are to be different. It's a trick, isn't it? Smoking. Smoking is a dirty, filthy habit that ruins health and takes a lot of money away from you and makes you a smelly, unpleasant person to be around. But smoking is not of the essence of morality or spirituality. It is an unfortunate addiction that people come to very often in their teenage years before they had the wit, the wisdom and the backbone to decide against it. And then it comes on them and it becomes a physiological addiction, which is very difficult to break free from. And if you're in this position, I do hope you'll take whatever steps and that you'll get as much encouragement and help from us as you can to be free of that addiction, because it's just an unhelpful addiction. There's nothing wrong with nicotine itself. In fact, I'm sure we'll find nicotine is going to be used more and more, and its pain-relieving qualities and all kinds of pharmaceutical advantages. But it is an addictive substance, especially when delivered down the lungs, like it has been. But you can be a Christian and smoke cigarettes, and you can be a Christian and not smoke cigarettes. And you can be a non-Christian and smoke cigarettes, and you can be a non-Christian and not smoke cigarettes. Smoking cigarettes has got nothing to do with being a Christian or not being a Christian. Yet, because the vast majority of Christians don't smoke, the smoker can feel alienated and excluded from the presence of Christians. And every now and then I see people come to church and And after church, they kind of hang around in the back of the parking lot, kind of having a fag together. And they're nearly all outsiders who have kind of come and feel alienated. And no Christian will go and stand near them because we wouldn't really be passive cancer carriers, would we? And so we just leave them like lepers to hang down the back of the cars and out the back of the toilets, which is where they learnt to smoke in the first place. That must not be the case, you see. Smoking is a matter of spiritual irrelevance. Because of that, we should have no difficulty in joining them and being free with them and encouraging those in their struggle against an addiction which is unpleasant and expensive, but to make sure that they feel thoroughly welcome. It is an irrelevance whether they do or don't smoke. Now, there are many, many issues like that. But what Jesus is dealing with are the issues where it does matter and where we need to be different. Otherwise, people won't recognise we're God's people. Otherwise, we've got nothing to offer because we ourselves are not in the kingdom of heaven. That's what we're dealing here in Matthew 5 to 7. That's why Matthew 5 to 7 is a very much more painful passage to deal with than 1 Corinthians 8, 9, 10. 8, 9, 10 just breaks down your cultural barriers and turns you into a multicultural person. 5, 6, 7 challenges your very heart and mind and godliness as to what life is all about. How about I pray? We'll talk over supper to each other about it, eh? Heavenly Father, we do thank you for your Son and for his challenging teaching to us, and we do pray, Father, that you would give to us such passion for you and your kingdom that we indeed would be your children, and as your children would live in such a way that people would see us and give praise and honour to you for what we do, for the good deeds they see. Help us, Father, to be so distinctively yours that we may indeed be the salt of the land, the light of the world, that we may be the city on a hill that draws attention to the Father who has created us. And we do pray for this in the name of the one who makes it possible, even Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.